This evening we have to complete our all too brief survey of Neoplatonism. And we have chosen a semi-detached personality to explain certain phases of this doctrine. There were many direct disciples of the original Neoplatonic group, but the influence of the sect extended beyond the boundaries of its own formal pattern, and touched particularly some of the nobler and most enlightened of the Roman leaders. We have a very bad general opinion of the Caesars, and for the most part, perhaps, our opinion is not ill-founded. Probably none of them were quite as bad as they have been painted, and very few of them as good as might be hoped. The two exceptions in this group of imperial persons are Marcus Aurelius Antoninus and Flavius Claudius Julianus. These two men were both learned, and by natures and temperaments devout. They were sincere, honorable persons. And while the circumstances of their time certainly prevented them from a full expression either of their natural inclinations or their potential genius, they have left important monuments. Works which have inspired the world far outside of the spheres of policy and diplomacy. The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius are among the noblest of the moral works of man. And the writings and various essays and pronouncements of the Emperor Julian must also be included among the great documents. In fact, his two orations, one to the sovereign son and the other to the mother of the gods, are outstanding among the great literary works of the world. We must, for instance, pause and consider the materials and situations that went into the temperament of Julianus. He was directly descended from Constantine the Great, and his political career reached its height in the years not far removed from the reign of Constantine. You'll remember that Constantine gathered the great Christian council of Nicaea, and there in about 326 AD, turned the destiny of the Roman Empire over to Christendom. This policy was not especially altered thereafter, except for a few brief interludes. And one of these interludes relates to the life of Julian. Julian was born of the imperial line, but came early in life under the jealousy of Constantius, who was then emperor, and who feared that the descendants of Constantine might ultimately take away his imperial place and life. Constantius, therefore, was responsible for the murder of all the descendants that could be traced of the imperial branch of the family of Constantine, with the exception of Julian and his brother. These two children were so young and so far removed from the political scene that it was not considered necessary to eliminate them. Julian spent his entire life, his early life, in exile and in prison. Constantius took no chances with the young man, but prevented him from having any of the natural privileges of the young. Although, as Julian himself tells us, he was never physically or actually abused. As a result of the peculiar seclusion and semi-state of imprisonment in which he lived, the young man early turned his mind to the deeper problems of life and thought. During the period of his youth and adolescence, he came rather strongly under the influence of Christian teachers. And as a result of the natural mystical sensitivity of his soul, he was inclined to embrace these teachings. Although, as he tells us, he was profoundly suspicious due to the circumstances involving Constantine the Great. He knew, as he tells us, that Constantine was not sincere, and that the entire problem of the great Nicene upheaval was a pretext used by Constantine to advance his own political destiny. But Julian, being by temperament a mystic, a naturally sensitive, retiring, quiet person, was not completely converted by his Christian associates, but he was impressed by them. And the more he considered the matter, the more deeply he was impressed, until he finally accepted baptism. And it was assumed that his life would then follow the new pattern of life in the Holy Roman Empire. It so happened, however, that Constantius, becoming more and more involved in foreign wars and internal broils, began to seek for someone upon whom he could depend and whom he could trust. In the meantime, the Empress Eusebia had taken a very great interest in young Julian. She saw in him a man growing into manhood with great and unusual capacities and abilities. She was therefore able to convince Constantius that it would be wise for him to turn to this kinsman, a man honorable and sincere, and put his trust, perhaps in the person he had so grievously wronged. Constantius agreed. In the due course of time, Julian was proclaimed Caesar by Constantius and given a sphere of activity beyond the Alps. This was the beginning of the career of this young man, who gradually, by his own merits and also to a degree by the general collapse of the Roman Empire around him, came finally to the imperial purple and was proclaimed Julian Augustus after it became evident that Constantius had lost the empire. Julian was born in Constantinople, and when the time came for him to solemnize as Pontifex Maximus, at the funeral of Constantius, he ordered the former emperor to be buried as he wished, with Christian rites. Although by this time Julian himself had changed his mind on some of these religious questions. It was known that while as Caesar, he extended the influence of Rome and protected it very largely, his own mind had gradually been changing. And as a result of this change, Julian finally formally renounced Christianity and restored or returned to the faith of his fathers. For this reason, he has been stigmatized in the church as Julian the Apostate. But actually, the circumstances leading to the various changes in his mind and thinking were perfectly natural of the kind of man that he was. Julian had a very short career as emperor. And 2 years after he had become invested with the full imperial power, he died on the field of battle, pursuing a defeated Persian army. Thus, for only a short time, did this man enjoy worldly power and glory, and Julian, one of the best emperors Rome ever had, departed from this world in his 32nd year. Thus, he had little, if any, time to ripen his philosophy, to produce out of himself the full maturity of his own thinking. Most of the works of Julian were done in tents on the battlefield. He wrote at night with the lights of lamps and candles. He had no leisure with which to study. And he often said that he regretted profoundly the destiny seemingly had demanded of him, that he renounce his allegiance to the Athenian Minerva and accept service in the army of the Roman Zeus. He had much rather remained to the end a scholar, but as this was denied of him, he did the best he could under the circumstances. Although he renounced Christianity as his own religion, Julian, when he issued his own imperial edicts, decreed complete and absolute tolerance within the empire. And at no time can it be truthfully said that he persecuted the Christians or did anything to injure them. It has been noted, perhaps unjustly, however, that he preferred to choose those nearest to himself from among the schools of philosophy with which his mind was most closely associated. Basically and fundamentally, Julian was a Platonist. But during his life, he came strongly under the influence of Neoplatonism, and this gradually resulted in the maturity of his philosophic thinking. Julian also has the distinction of being one of the few Roman emperors who was actually an initiate of the mysteries. It is known that as Pontifex Maximus, as the emperor, it was customary for the Roman imperial line to assume deification. The Roman emperor was a theocratic ruler. He was a god. And it was therefore his duty to preside over the state mysteries. But as we may suspect from the general state of Rome, the political mysteries of Rome were by no means mature or pure. And very few of the Roman emperors were ever able to receive admission into the greater and deeper schools of philosophy existing in other regions. Julian was one of the exceptions. Julian was initiated into the great mysteries of Ephesus. He was accepted into the cult of Diana, the great goddess of the Ephesians. And he was initiated in crypts under the city of Ephesus, and his initiator was Maximus the Neoplatonist. Julian also was initiated into the mysteries of the Persian Mithras, from which mysteries he learned many things, including a new meaning for the mysterious baptism of blood. By means of the blood of the Son, the sins of man are washed away. Julian was also initiated in Greece, and therefore cast his lot with that great descent of priest philosophers who have made such rich contributions to our common good. He was initiated into the rites of the goddess Cybele, sometimes known as the Mother of Mysteries, the Mater Deorum, the Mother of the Gods. And it is from these circumstances relating to his own initiation and to his own experiences in the sacred rites that Julian prepared his great oration to the Mother of the Gods. Now, the oration, as a great literary work, is almost unexcelled. But our principal interest lies not in this literary implication, but between the lines, in the hints arcanely dropped by one who had passed through the rites and therefore was bound by an obligation neither to expose nor to reveal, but to hold most sacred those things in themselves most sacred. Thus we cannot turn to Julian and expect to find an expose of the great mystery system. We can, however, through the references which he himself derives from Platonic and Neoplatonic sources, from the contemporary records of Julian's own life, and from the contents of his great orations and his work, Julian Against the Christians, we can find certain indications of the circumstances and the type of mind and the philosophy with which he was familiar. We have said that he died too young to have perfected his system or have made his own mature contributions upon the platform or level of reflection. He was still a young man, groping after many things. but that he had found something, we know. And that with the things he had found came great patience and consolation of spirit. So that in his last hours, with the arrow of a Persian soldier in his liver, Julian faced the end with the greatest of serenity, his last words being for the consideration of those around him and not for his own need. He died contrary to all fables and legends to the contrary, in peace with himself and the world, believing deep profoundly in the Platonic doctrine that he had an everlasting estate, and that in this everlastingness all good things would be fulfilled. Julian believed himself to be descended from the god Mercury, but this only implies that he was born under the sign ruled by the planet Mercury. This was the common way of distinguishing persons in his time. He believed that the ruling genius of his horoscope was the mysterious, invisible parent from whom he came. Julian also had one other strange and rather profound obsession. He firmly believed in rebirth and was convinced that in a previous life he had been Alexander the Great. The fate of Alexander, who also died as a young man, and the circumstances of his death, and many of the incidents in the life of Julian, parallel so closely that perhaps there might be some truth in his belief. In any event, he held to it very firmly, going so far as attempting to expiate, as Julian, crimes and sins which he believed that he had committed as Alexander. So with this little outline of the character and manner of Julian, but with no ability to enter into the strange and wonderful genius of this man, who had talents and abilities far above those of the average person, we must consider his approach to religion. Now here we have an interesting problem that perhaps is different from that of any of the other Neoplatonists whom we are considering. Here we have a man who devoutly and honestly became a Christian, then turned from this faith and returned to the doctrines of Plato and Neoplatonism. Yet he had received his Christian education at a very early and tender period of his life. And during those formative and adolescent years, he had been strongly impressed by the sincerity and dedication and devotion of certain Christian priests and teachers whom he had known. It was not until public life brought him in contact with the political pressures of the new sect that he became disillusioned. As a young man, he believed very devoutly in the essential goodness of these men with whom he confided and who had taught him. So we have a man returning later to a non-Christian position as a philosopher, scholar, and thinker, and yet undoubtedly bringing with him into this new attitude which he assumed, and we know from his own writings with the absolute sincerity of a dedicated person, that we will have a mixture or a combination of elements arising in the philosophy of Julian, which is going to distinguish him somewhat from the other late pagan writers who were preserving the Platonic descent. Julian, though a philosopher of good parts and a scholar of abilities, was essentially in his own personal life a mystic. He was a mystic inasmuch as he was moved most powerfully and strongly from certain deep sources and roots within himself. His writings are colored by tremendous emotional intensity. He had a great and sublime sense of the dignity of life. And like most of the Neoplatonists, his mysticism led him into interpretation. He was not inclined to accept anything upon its face appearance or upon its literal values. He sought always meaning, and he sought meaning that would satisfy the hunger of his own search for truth. Julian had already long realized that truth was not a word, and he had fully come to appreciate that the attainment of internal security was by a kind of exaltation within himself. He on several occasions had transcendental experiences, and some of the church fathers accused him of being a magician. Actually, he did have visions. He did have an inner contact of some kind with a larger world of realities, a world which flowing through him, as he himself expresses it, gave him security from himself and not from his world. It was this security that sustained him through the cabals and conspiracies of the Roman court. And it was this same mysterious internal security that left him untouched by elevation and serene in death. So we have in Julian a man who was moved and motivated, as far as we can find, from every action, the public pronouncement, every private memoir, a man absolutely dedicated to what he believed to be duty, responsibility, honor, integrity, and truth. He admitted himself that he might not know fully the meaning of any of these words, but that it was as it was given to him to know that he would do, regardless of cost to himself, regardless of whether it brought him success or death. It brought him death, which has not been unusual in cases of this kind. The great oration to the Mother of the Gods is a veiled unfoldment of the great rituals of the mysteries. And it is therefore important that we use it as a springboard in an effort to understand the mystery system as it then continued to survive and flourish, although in a few centuries it was to pass away from the pages of history in the Western motion of civilization. To Julian, the Mother of the Gods was the mysteries. Of course, he will not tell us this directly. To do so would violate his obligation. He can only intimate to us the sacred facts involved. The great Mother of the Gods, Cybele, presided brooding and serene, strange and detached, over her great rites and ceremonies. Dark Diana, the Multimania, the Great Mother, Mother of Mysteries, Mother of Life, Goddess of the Ephesians, also brooded strange and mysterious over her sanctuary. She was again but another form of Isis, the Eternal Widow, the Egyptian Mother of Mysteries, seeking, moaning and pitiful, for the dismembered body of her murdered lord. Julian recognizes these fables, refers to them, mentions them, and tells us what they all mean. Julian therefore explains, partly in this oration and partly in some of his other works, and deriving intimations from Neoplatonic writers who can further be consulted, that it was the belief of those who had taken the obligations and the vows, that in the dawn of time, in the beginning of things, the great wisdom, the eternal gods, had set up their sacred institutions among men, that truth might not perish. And these sacred institutions were guarded generation after generation. And the laws of these institutions and the sacred rites and the ceremonies, the secret instruction, the disciplines, the tests and the trials, were all according to the oracular revelations of the gods themselves, who in the beginnings of time had established these rites and appointed their priests, from whom all the hierophants and masters of the rites from that time on had descended by an ordination, by the same kind of strange mystic secret transference of power and authority that we think of in Christianity under the term the apostolic succession. This succession of rites, preserved through the sacraments and through the laying on of hands, and through the dedication of lives, meant that the great institutions had come down always as custodians of the great work. Now man is born into this world from the womb of his mother, and his days are few and full of troubles. And according to both pagan and Christian mystic writings, this man who is few of days has only one hope, and that is that by some wonderful and sacred reality beyond his comprehension, he may, while still alive, die and be raised again. Therefore, the sacred institutions were the houses of the second birth, the houses from which a man is born again, from the womb of the mysteries, from the heart, soul, and body of the Great Mother, who is forever bearing her sons, and yet to the end is forever a virgin. This is the song that Julian sings to us, the song of the house of wisdom. For wisdom has builded its house, and here it dwells, waiting for its sons. This wisdom is Pallas Athena, the patron goddess of Athens, the crown city, the queen of the house of learning. This is Cybele, Melita, Astarte, Ishta, all the great mothers, the mothers of rites, the mothers who give birth to the immortal sons who never die. The ritual perhaps began in Egypt, for it is certain that there, Isis mourning for her lord represents the great institution of the state religion. Isis was not primarily regarded in the mysteries as a person, but was the bride of heaven. In the Apocalypse of John, which derives part of its authority from the rites of Phrygia, which were practiced in the area around Patmos, where it is said John was for long exiled. In these rites, we have a new understanding from the Book of Revelation of the mystery of the bridegroom, and the marriage of the city of Jerusalem to the Lamb. And Jerusalem was adorned as a bride. This marriage of Jerusalem to the Lamb of Heaven is the story that lies at the root of the great cycle of Isis and Osiris. Actually, Osiris represents the eternal wisdom principle. Isis, his consort, is his house, or his institution in the world. Isis, therefore, represents the great theocratic order, just as truly as the same is perpetuated in Christianity under the symbolism of the Virgin Mary. Isis, the Virgin Mary, Cybele, and the great Diana are therefore the magnificent organizations or institutions built up out of the world for the worship and adoration of the gods. This is, again, a very interesting psychical or psychological mystery. For the temple is always the symbol of the human soul. The temple is suspended like man's soul between spirit and body. A spirit descends from the invisible and divine world to possess and ensoul. So the psychic nature itself, the human soul, ascending out of the complication and mystery of matter, rises from its own mortality and sphinx-like guards the gates of wisdom. This soul, then, redeemed out of body, purified from body, is the Holy City, the New Jerusalem of St. Augustine. And it is the human soul that is then the bride of the Lamb. And the great theocratic and sacerdotal systems of the pagan world were regarded as these sacred cities that became united eternally to the god who was their patron deity. Now in the Isis and Osiris cycle, Osiris, the great one, or the great deity, is foully murdered by his own brother. And Isis, the mysteries, becomes widowed and barren. And she puts upon her head sackcloth and ashes. And she goes forth weeping for her Lord, seeking always and forever for the mysterious power, the great rites, the secret lost word that must be found, or the great arcana cannot be restored. And Isis, seeking for her Lord, is, as we might say it, the concept of knowledge, the concept of education, the great concept of universities and colleges as we know them today. To the ancients, they would have been the widowed Isis weeping for her Lord, searching everywhere for him, but not able to find him. This quest is the quest for knowledge, the eternal search for the eternal vanities. Now in the Isis-Osiris cycle, while Isis is wandering in her widow's weeds, searching for that which is lost forever, there appears to her the specter of her own deceased husband. Osiris comes in the form of a Holy Spirit. Osiris comes in the form of the Holy Ghost. And he comes to announce to her that she shall bear a son, and that this son shall be for the salvation of the nations. And therefore it is said that Isis conceived of the Holy Spirit of her own deceased husband. And she brought forth Horus the Younger, the child that was born after his father was dead. In fact, was conceived after his father was dead. Therefore, he was born of a Holy Spirit. He was a widow's son. He was one dedicated to a strange and wonderful destiny. And Typhon, the assassin of Osiris and the wicked brother, discovering that this child had been born, sent forth emissaries to all parts of Egypt to discover the child and slay him. And in this course, there is also reference to the slaughter of innocent children who were mistaken for him. But Isis, guided by Mercury, hid her child where none could find it, hiding it in the reeds by the side of the river Nile. And the child was saved and grew up to be a fine and splendid man. And when this had occurred, and when the time came for the child's lock of hair to be cut off, and Horus came into his adolescent period, which is the second period of life in ancient Egypt. And then Isis received from the ghost of her husband Osiris the promise that he would be forever present with this child and would guide him and lead him. And when Horus the Younger reached his 30th year, which was the Egyptian age of maturity, on that occasion a strange and wonderful thing happened. For at that time, Osiris, the god himself, entered into the body of his own son and was born in him and took over and became the ruler of that body. So that in this mystery, as the ancient Egyptian papyrus tells us, the father and the son were identical. And then it was that Osiris proudly cries out, "Who hath seen the Father hath seen the Son, for the Son is in the Father, and the Father is in the Son, and they are one being to eternity." This was pronounced 1,000 years B.C. Now this mystery goes into many ramifications, but Osiris always represents the great mystery itself, the eternal truth, the living power. And Isis, widow of her Lord, is the priesthood, the sacerdotal institutions, the schools of the mysteries. And the son that is born of the invisible spirit and the widowed wife is Horus the Hersheshta, the son of the hawk, the redeemer, the light bearer, the intercessor, the one who stands in the hall of judgment with every soul that dies and pleads with the Father for the forgiveness of its sin. And Horus is the one who, when the soul of the dead person seems to be lost, takes upon itself the sin of the dead, and in that way gains its redemption.
These old rites and mysteries go way back. Julian knew them. Julian had been through the sacred rites. He knew what their meanings were and what they portended in a world seeking truth. And so Isis is the great house, the house of God on earth. Isis was the many-roomed chambers of initiation, the dark hidden womb from which flow the ever-born ones, the sons of the hawk, the armies of the redeemed, who shall sometime in the last great war, which is the Armageddon, will be locked in eternal struggle with the powers of darkness, and in the end, in those times beyond eternity and time, right shall be victorious, and the kingdom shall be returned to Osiris the Father, who will come in glory and receive unto himself his beloved Son. All these rites are not the theological stories that we know today. They had a much deeper and more precious meaning to the initiates of that time. The great Diana, mother of the Ephesians, the brooding power of the moon, hovering over the great temple of Ephesus, was likewise this mysterious story of the psychic content and the building of the human soul, and how through the union of a Holy Spirit invisible and a corporeal body, the mother, there is born the radiant soul, which is the salvation of the world. This, in turn, causes the initiate or the adeptus of the ancient rites to be considered as a personification and embodiment of the principle of soul. Here we can pause for just a second and remind you of the heroic estate we described last week in the Wanderings of Ulysses. The heroes are the soul beings, those who have built for themselves this house, this tabernacle within, which is to be their habitation. So through the power of the mysteries, the breath of life is breathed into a man and he becomes a living being. And this living being is the psychic entity, the mysterious energy or power of the soul. Julianus tells us some more of these things, and he points out something that I think is very interesting. He points out that in these rites, whether they be at Samothrace or Ephesus, whether they be among the Phrygians or in the mysteries of the Goths and the Gauls, all of these rites were presented in the forms of great pageantries. The pageantries of Eleusis are particularly remembered, but they were no more remarkable or important than those practiced in other places. The neophyte, seeking admission into these rites, and having passed through certain preparatory examinations and tests, is brought into the ceremony, and there he is a witness. He is a beholder. What he was is perhaps borrowed from a line in Plato, because Plato, an initiate, was once asked his profession, and he replied, "I am a spectator." This means, of course, that he accepted the entire pageantry of life as a drama of initiation, although very few modern writers, including dear old Jowett, ever realized that fact. In the rituals, Apuleius, who preceded Julian in these rites, and Hadrianus, and Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, who also was initiated at Ephesus, all of these who went before joined with Julian in bearing testimony to something that is undoubtedly the secret and the very heart of the mystery. They all declared that when they entered into the temple as candidates for the mysteries or for initiation, that they actually went through an experience. Apollonius of Tyana, at a still earlier date than these men, had testified to the same thing. Namely, that when they entered the house of the goddess, or the great house of the mother, that is, they returned to the womb for a second birth, that an occurrence or a happening took place which could not be explained in any terms or any words known to man. As the great drama of initiation unfolded, from the soul of the candidate, the story of the truth behind the picture was revived or restored. So that, as the ancient initiate said, the soul or the psychic entity within himself stirred in its sleep, awoke, and remembered the long road it had come, and realized the reason for its own journey. Thus, in some way, the rituals brought about from the individual a restoration of his own psychic memory. There are many answers to how this could have been. Some of the profane and not too happy commentators on these subjects have suggested that the candidates were hypnotized, or that they were drugged, or that something was done to disorder their senses so that they seemed to pass through impossible situations. I doubt if either was true. I think the answer lies in the ritual itself. Remember, these rites were preserved inviolate, without change, upon the strongest admonition of the gods and the oracles. Not one line, not one motion, not one word could be altered. It must be preserved complete, inviolate. Man must add nothing and take away nothing. For the peculiar power of the rite lay in its own structure and the unfoldment which it accomplished. Those who have written briefly upon these ceremonies, particularly those who passed through them and could not say much, and some who arcanely concealed them under subterfuge and veiled term, particularly I'm thinking of the Grecian poet Aristophanes, who in his Frogs and his Winds, two of his supposed comedies, gives us part of the ritual. These rites unfolded according to a peculiar sequence. As Plotinus says, they opened like a flower and bore their fruit. The entire situation was so perfectly and completely ordered that in some mysterious way it brought about some of the chemistry, some of the psychic chemistry implied by Plotinus in his essay on the beautiful, which we have also described. In the rites, then, as in the approach of beauty, the soul in man was said to burst forth in joy, to embrace its own likeness. Thus the rituals were a magnificent, integrated, psychological structures which could rouse through reminiscence, through recollection, through similarity, and through association, the sleeping remembrances that are locked within the psychic life of the individual. These rituals then called him forth out of the darkness of his own sleep and caused him to awaken. And while the rites were proceeding, he lived them, he experienced them, because they were unfolding in tone and order and picture and color and design the very structure of his own psychic life. He responded because they were revealing to him an absolute similitude of his own soul. A man being thus brought into the presence of that which is himself, and recognizing those patterns and pageantries which instinctively he receives and responds to by ancient instincts which he cannot even explain or understand. These rituals then were mandalas. They were concentration fields by which the disciple or the candidate was lured from the darkness of his own sleep. In him, then, the soul which had slumbered, which had been unable to rouse itself by its own vigilance alone, was able to be revived and to be restored to its own waking state. those who attained this or received this apotheosis within themselves were said to have been like Apuleius, brought forth into the presence of the great and glorious God. And in this procedure were enabled to revive the divine memory, the intuitive power, the inspirational faculty, which had slept within them since the time of their embodiment in form. Julian implies to us all of this. He tells us then that these things are not just dramas. They are something in themselves ineffable and sublime, worthy of admiration, and suitable to cause the one who passes through them to come to the greatest devotion and to the most utter and complete humility. Plato is said to have referred to the rites of Eleusis in such terms of approbation that the importance of these ceremonies cannot be doubted. For he tells us that in the presence of the great rituals, he was as a small child, knowing nothing. This, however, was not due to instruction. The rituals did not teach, they released. They caused the individual to see almost dream symbolic equivalents of his own psychic life. And this brings us to a situation that might have considerable bearing upon modern thinking. We are now concerned in analytical psychological research with the problem of the interpretation of symbolic patterns from within the subconscious and the unconscious of man. We feel that man is moving from within outward through the projection from himself of symbolic forms which bear witness to the geometrical proportions of his own psychic life. Therefore, the individual in his dreams or in his waking dreams, in his instinctive likes and dislikes, in the decisions and choices which he makes, in the person he may choose to marry, in his attitude towards life and his world, in all these things, the individual is drawing something from himself, is causing symbolic forms and shadows to come to the surface from the deep sources and fountains of his own existence. Now, the difference between this and the great rituals of the Mother of the Gods may be worthy of our consideration. For in these rituals, the qualities with which man is most concerned are lured from himself by presentation of symbol to him and not merely released through him in a heterogeneous collection of dissonant elements. In other words, if these symbolic forms which come from man represent various impersonations of his instincts, then these instincts have potential forms or symbolical equivalents. And if the most divine of these instincts are pictured to man, he will experience them and find that these pictures will call upon his own inner remembrances and release these symbolic patterns from within himself. In the common ordinary life of man, most of his environmental circumstances do not directly release, because they are in themselves asymmetrical. They are in themselves compromises, materialistic emphases, and the individual is not in the presence of sheer beauty, nor is he in the presence of sheer goodness, as far as man is capable of contriving these terms or the elements and principles for which they stand. So the neophyte or the candidate for initiation enters the secret house. He isolates himself from the world. He enters into another kind of world, which might be likened in itself to his own inner life. He discovers, like the Melchizedek mystery of old, that in the rebirth of his own inner life, he must be his own father and his own mother. He enters into these rites, into an unworldly state of detachment from all material things, from all normal or materialistic instincts and appetites. And here, in an atmosphere of the most detached sanctity, in an atmosphere itself redundant with beauty, full of love and nobility, always in gentleness, peace, and dignity, the neophyte advances toward the pageantries by which he is supposed to be so profoundly touched. And gradually the great spectacles open before him. And he beholds not the gods or their strange ways and symbols, but he beholds a series of pictures which are the reflections of his own heart and mind. Each of the things that happen breaks silences within himself and cause him to become articulate of ideals and principles and beliefs. As this rushing unfoldment takes him, he may then very well pass into a state of enthusiasm, which is from entheus, meaning in God. He may find himself suddenly possessed by powers beyond his comprehension, moved by forces that he cannot resist, until it seems that an internal world bursts through him and around him. And he finds himself like Apuleius, standing at midnight upon the threshold of Persephone, with the great, radiant and glorious sun of noon shining under his feet. He beholds himself transported from one sphere or world to another. He enters into the abode of the dead being the dark part of himself. He there faces all of the pressures, evils, and symbolic fantasies of his own psyche. He is victorious over darkness and evil. He is restored again to light. He remains 3 days in the underworld, or 3 degrees. Then he is resurrected and brought into the presence of the Hierophant of the Mysteries, the Grand Master in his robes of blue and gold. And here he is crowned and coroneted as a master of the inner life. And he is presented with the symbols and powers of his new authority. But long before these things have happened, as Apuleius points out, the soul itself has become so completely enamored of the transcendental beauty of the divine that it is no longer scarcely to be considered in this world at all. It moves strangely as in a sleep of waking. It beholds all things in new order and relationship. It beholds gradually the breaking open of the walls of the temple until, as one of the initiates says, all vanished except time and space and heaven and earth, and the whole world became the eternal temple. All these things were experiences strangely and wonderfully psychologically released by the great pageantry of the rites. And because of the tremendous power of these rites, with their mantrams, with their songs, with their sacred circumambulations, with the mystic dances of the muses and the graces, and all the strange parts of these stories, that which finally ended brought with it a complete and tremendous apotheistic change within the consciousness of the neophyte. He became the initiate, not because his mind had accepted the instruction, not because simply his emotions had been purified or cleansed, for these cathartic disciplines came first. He was an initiate because of a complete transcendent experience, an experience which could never be assailed by his own reason, which could never be denied by his own mind, because he had been there, because this had happened to him, and because in the course of the great ritual he had come face to face with the gods themselves. Now, were these gods truly masked priests? They may have been. But also every mask, every robe, every symbol was chosen with a strange and wonderful skill. The gods the man saw may have been masked priests, but the gods that came to him from within himself were not. For these various shadows man made, even with the greatest solemnity and care, became in themselves ensouled. And these images of divine things, as Plotinus calls them, become strange magical agents, drawing to themselves the real principles for which they stand, so that that which is in the likeness of the god is never entirely separate from the god, because the believer can experience the God in the likeness. And that which comes to the person who understands or accepts the mystery is not the symbol, but the substance or energy which is released through the symbol. Having received the rite, the initiate then goes forth upon the porch of the temple, and he finds that the citizens of the villages around and of the towns have all gathered for the wonderful ceremony of receiving him back again into the world of the objectively living. For he has gone down into the great mystery. He has returned to the womb of eternity. He has been born again of the great mother. And he has come forth out of his alma mater. For the form is preserved even in our present university system, although the meaning is lost. He comes forth out of the mother of learning. But he has not been taught by the mind alone. He has been taught by the soul in a mystery. And he is hailed on the pillars, as he stands between the pillars of the porch, he is hailed as one twice born, the reborn one,